This is an oral history interview, Anna Holden, for the Michigan Environmental Justice Records. Interviewer, James Goodman, Wayne State University. Good afternoon, Ms. Holden.
Oh, good afternoon.
I just want to start out by, could you tell me a little bit about your upbringing, when you were born, where, and
things well, like that? I was born in Ocala, Florida, which is dead center in the middle of the state, and a small town. My parents were both pioneers. My ancestors were both pioneers in Florida, on both sides of the family. And so we have a long history in Florida. And my father was a citrus grower and truck farmer in the community where he grew up, which was near Gainesville. And my mother had taught school before she got married. And so we grew up in a small community that had a small minority of Catholics and Jews, and was mostly Protestant, Baptist, Methodist mm-hmm. population. And so I came up in an era when there was still suspicion against Catholics.
And when were you born?
I was born in 1928. And my parents, as I say, were born and raised in Florida. And of course, they had experienced much more difficult, their aunts had more difficult conditions, in that area. Because Catholics were not that. Really? Were not accepted very much in their generation, certainly. And in my generation, I went to Catholic school for 8 years, and we had no high school. And so we got a good, we transferred into the high school. We were all well educated. And we had a mix in the Catholic school of all the Jewish children attended there and the rich Protestant children. And the Catholic, it was the only private school in that area at that time, and so, in any event, but things were as World War II, came along, and things, we began to get, different influences. So, anyway, and then I went to college at what was Florida State College for Women, and became Florida State University very soon after I enrolled there because at the end of World War II, a lot of GIs that had been in Florida training, a lot of training bases, what came back to Florida. When in the school, the University of Florida was overcrowded and they couldn't handle them all. So they sent them to Florida State College for Women. in the Tallahassee branch of the University of Florida. And by the next time the legislature met, they made both schools co-ed. They were men's and women's schools before that time. So that's where my education got started. And I guess how much more detail you want to go into?
After the college, you left Florida?
I went to graduate school at the University of North Carolina, and I did a master's degree there in sociology and anthropology.
And then after graduating from there?
Well, I went to work in Atlanta with the Southern Regional Council. I got interested in race relations when I was at Florida State. And I worked in the University of North Carolina for a man named Guy Johnson, who was very active in race relations issues. A lot of interest in various aspects of it, including he was on the board of directors of the Southern Regional Council, which was a biracial organization that was active at that throughout the South on trying to influence people's racial attitudes. And initially, we were not openly against segregation, but that happened as a school desegregation issues went forward. And but at that time, there was a tremendous amount of active, obvious, acceptable racism in the South. And the Klan was very active in Atlanta, for example, burning the cross up on Stone Mountain, And Talmadge, it was a Talmadge governor that was, there was an awful lot of there was an awful lot of racism mm-hmm. in that area. And so I worked with them 4 years, and then I went to work with Fisk University in Nashville, which is one of the historic black colleges. And I was worked there as a race relations and in studies and research in race, and some teaching was teaching undergraduate level students how to do research surveys, community surveys.
So while you were growing up, you said there was a Guy Johnson.
He was, yeah, it was my main professor when I was at North Carolina.
Were there other people when you were growing up that were like a mentor or an inspiration?
Well, that was then when I was in graduate school.
Right, so before that, possibly.
Well, my mother was always a great influence in my life. She came out of a family where both of her parents had died before they were 50, and her mother was a widow, a young widow with a family to raise, and then after she was teaching school, she went back to Ocala to take care of her mother. My grandmother died of breast cancer. And so my mother left teaching and went home to take care of her. And then she died. And then she had this younger sister and brother that were still
to raise.
So, yeah, so she postponed, you know.
And that was Ocala?
Ocala. Yeah, it's a much larger community now. And it's an attractive place, that area, for retirees that are not wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
But,
in Florida.
You know, can relocate for the winter or year-round. And the richer people go further down to the Gold Coast, and Palm Beach, and so forth. But Ocala is a community that was an outgrowth of the Seminole Wars, and one of the Seminole Wars, and because there were many. And it was established as a community after one of the Seminole Wars concluded. They never settled in Seminole Wars, you know. They're still at war with the United States. But they did settle eventually with the state of Florida so that they would get some social benefits and so forth. But anyway, we have Seminole history in our background.
Wow.
And where were we? Mentors. My mother... My mother was very strong in terms of her own independence and her own. She's well educated, and she taught. One of the things that she stressed with my sister and I was that we should prepare ourselves to be self-sufficient and independent. You know, you may get married, you may not, but even if you get married, there's no guarantee. You know, but you must prepare yourselves to take care of yourselves. And she was very strong on women having provincial credentials so that she could be self-supporting and independent. And so my sister went into nursing, and I ended up in sociology, which was not a good choice, except that I had the journalism background, the writing skills. And so the sociologists and the economists can't write, you know. So you can get jobs editing their work, writing up the data. Yeah. So there's always a job, you know, if you have the writing skills.
That's good. So we last left you off talking about you were working in North Carolina.
Well, I was in school there.
Okay, in school there. And then from there you went and...
To Atlanta.
Atlanta, okay. Mm-hmm. And you were helping students?
No. I was working with the Southern Regional Council, which was a race relations agency. It went back to 1919 and lynching and so forth. And we had constituency. We had member organizations in the different states. And the state was to educate people about... You know, the facts of, you know, what the racial situation, the racial divide was all about, the economics of it and the lack of opportunity and so forth. And it was a biracial group, and our board of directors included faculty from the Atlanta Black Historic Colleges, Spelman and Morehouse and so forth. And they were involved in a lot of other things, of course. But we published a newsletter, and we furnished information for the for press or people that were doing writing and an analysis of racial problems. So I was a research assistant, and I worked with, you know, having information available, factual information, you know, available for people, reporters and people that were interested in, you know, a more factual approach to the situation. And I wrote articles for our newsletter, and I did small little research projects on.
What was the newsletter called?
The New South.
The New South.
I've got some background information you can look at if you want to. So I, as I say, I was worked with them for 4 years, and about the time after the Brown versus Board of Education, that school desegregation came down, it began to kind of loosen up.
And that year, that was 1960.
Is this, what, 1950? Wait a minute. We just a 50-year celebration recently. I should remember that.
1964?
No, it was before that. Okay. It was before that. I went to work for the council in 1951, and it was in the, I think it was 1950, I think. I'm not sure. Okay. Well, that's...
We'll check.
We'll check, yeah. But as I say, that court decision, of course, launched attempts to desegregate schools in various parts of the South, and I worked a lot on school desegregation with various research projects. And the Fisk University had a race relations department, and then I was in the sociology department 3 years and 1 year in the race relations. And we participated in a lot of studies that were going on, and they needed white interviewers, you know, to talk. I was always getting out to interview the white people, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I saw, you know, and we published reports, and we worked with the Anti-Defamation League and other organizations that were trying to provide people with some guidelines and some understanding of the importance of desegregation, and that it be carried out, you know, on a nonviolent and regional basis. And so I worked, as I say, with Fisk University for 4 years. And during the latter part of that time, I got involved with the Congress of Racial Equality, which we were the first chapter in the South. And we got involved just about the time the desegregation issue was coming to a head, and there was a court decision to desegregate the Nashville schools. So I was active with the core group there, and working with parents and people in the community that wanted to have the integration, wanted people to participate in it.
Mm-hmm. This was in Nashville,
and yes, to participate in it, and also to have it to be not to be an area where you had a lot of violence and retaliation against the black community that was getting involved in integration. So that was a time when you had a lot of unrest and racial tension, and these areas where we were desegregating schools for the first time. So.
And what led you to go to Nashville? Were you
a job?
I mean, you on your own. They weren't recommending you go there. You looked and researched and went there.
I'm not involved with that. I was ready for a change.
Yes.
In terms of the growth of my own interest and my own ideas about, you know, what we should be doing, you know, in terms of the racial situation. And Southern Regional Council, I'd say they began to be more forthright, I guess you would say, after the Brown decision. But I was interested in getting more, a little more involved, mm-hmm. in a more overt way, I guess you would say, more. So I got a job with Fisk University, and I worked there for 4 years, and I was laid off in a money crunch. So I went to University of Michigan to graduate school as a way of getting out. I couldn't get a job in the South, so I went there as a way of getting out of the South and getting some, you know, some way of establishing, you know, some credentials and some places I could work and get a job. You know, that was the key issue. Mm-hmm.
And so you were then in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Yes, I was in Ann Arbor. So I was 4 years in Ann Arbor after I left Fisk, and worked with these. I went to graduate school only a year, and I didn't like the graduate school there. I didn't like the the way it went. That was a mistake in terms of where I should have gone for graduate school. But I worked for the Institute for Social Research there after I quit graduate school after a year, and I worked 3 years with the Institute for Social Research there on a juvenile delinquency project.
What did that job entail?
Editing and writing, rewriting. So they had a major study that they had, you know, done a lot of field work and on it, and they were writing reports on it, doing analysis of the data that had been collected. So I was not involved in data collection. The data was already collected. So we had, but it was a large study, and you know, you have to get these reports out, you know. And so
when you were in Ann Arbor, you worked for that group, and then after that, where did you go?
I went to Washington, D.C. to work on a study of poverty, called the so-called cultural poverty. Was a black anthropologist that I had known when I was in Atlanta. He was on the staff at Atlanta University, and he had a grant to study the poverty level people in Washington, D.C.
What was his name?
Hyland Lewis.
Hyland Lewis.
And so again, they had already collected a lot of data when I went to work for them. And I was helping edit data and rewrite reports and edit reports and as a research assistant. That study was really a benchmark, landmark kind of study, because one of the books that came out of that, I don't know if you been into these social studies classes, but street corner, what was it? It became almost an instant classic, and was used in teaching street corner society.
I haven't heard of that.
Well, it's about guys hanging out on the street.
Oh, you know? Okay.
the street corner society. There was another book published. One of the staff members lived in a public housing project, and she wrote a book called Living Poor, and that is not as well known as the other one. But and Dr. Lewis did a tremendous amount of we published a lot of pamphlets out of that study, and at that time the whole idea of the culture of poverty was popular with politicians. Mm-hmm. You know, and how it was such a separate culture. You know, they weren't like really Americans. You know, the black people that were on welfare, you know, were the target of a lot of the conservative. This was, you know, the period where you had the McCarthy hearings, all that, and you know the situation was such that, you know, liberal people and very progressive people, they were at risk in a lot of, in terms of jobs, a lot of.
I actually did one of my research papers on that, the Red Scare in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, it wasn't just in Michigan. Right. I'm in the red file, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you couldn't believe how inaccurate it was.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, it was just totally inaccurate. The people that were hanging out, I guess, and spying on us had no clue what was going on here. Well, but in any event, I worked for that study, and then I came back to Michigan after that and worked for the city of Detroit for 20 years in the job training program with the federal job training money. So.
And now you've been in this area ever since?
Mm-hmm.
And you've been in this area ever since then?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. I finally settled down. I realized that if I was going to retire someday, I have to start, you know, working on these jobs where there was no future. You know, it was just studies, and, you know, they're gone, then you have to get another job and so forth.
But a lot of that was with social justice.
Yes.
And then you started getting into environmental justice.
Well, I got involved with Sierra Club at the time that I had several friends, two very good friends, that were diagnosed with breast cancer. And then there were a couple of women that I had worked with that, you know, I knew professionally in this city that also were diagnosed with breast cancer. And, you know, I got to thinking, well, you know, all this business of working on women's issues, working on poverty issues and all, it's no good if you're going to die of cancer, you know, at a young age. So I did some background checking, and I joined Sierra Club because they basically have a democratic structure, which many of the environmental groups that don't have a democratic structure in terms of people electing, you know, local groups being organized and electing their own leaders and making their own decisions about what they're going to do and so forth. Mm. So I got involved in that because of the health issues and the tremendous amount of pollution that is in Detroit, still in Detroit. You know, the industrial heritage of all these plants that pollute and are allowed to pollute, and they're not necessarily well regulated. That's still a very controversial issue. But as I say, and then when I retired from the city, 1993, I got more actively involved because I had the time.
Mm-hmm. So you told me a little bit about the first annual Washington Summit in Washington, D.C., and that issued in different issues nationally, like it brought to the forefront, like environmental racism.
Well, I'm not sure. The Washington Summit, in terms of environmental justice, was a benchmark, gathering. I had nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a black minority, okay. Summit.
But you know something about it and what it meant.
Well,
afterwards.
What it meant was that people came back from that conference inspired and realizing, you know, that there was a format to work under in terms of promoting issues and giving minority people a stronger voice and, you know, inserting their rights to have a healthy situation to live in and to have not to be overburdened within their communities with pollution and decisions made by companies and municipal cities, states that expose them to more hazards than the white communities that were better off and were not picked as sites for a lot of the plants and so forth, that they were more protected. So what happened in Detroit was that the people who came back from that summit, they learned a lot about what was going on within the environmental movement in terms of their issues were largely ignored as a community in terms of health protection and protection from the negative impacts of emissions and water and whatever polluting. So we had, as a result of that, we had the first organization that became active was the Detroit is Working for Environmental Justice, which Donnell Wilkins headed. And she was the one that really pioneered that and got an active organization that was self-supporting that could raise those issues. And they weren't interested in particularly in whites being involved in this because they were trying to get their own voice and make their own decisions. And Sierra Club was one of the major national organizations. Of course, it was on the list of criticism for its policies and its practices that they were accused of ignoring, you know, not using the influence of the club in affecting decisions related to protecting people from pollution, especially in these minority areas where you had so many industrial plants located and so many sources of pollution. And it is so since that time, you know, we've had a lot of activity that is in this area around environmental justice. And one of the things that Sierra Club did was is a reaction to all the criticism that they got as a national organization. They set up some pilot programs there were four cities picked initially for the environmental justice programs, where they hired staff and made provisions for Sierra Club staff to work on environmental justice as a program issue. And we got one of those grants because New York turned down a grant that they were offered. Our executive director at that time had applied for a grant that we were based in Detroit. And it was to be Sierra Club. It was not to be a freestanding organization. And New York City got a grant, and they wanted to give the money to an existing organization that had been set up, and instead of doing it in Sierra Club. But the policy, the national policy, was that it would be the Sierra Club's project, and it would be a part of the club. And they weren't giving the money to fund anything outside of the club. So we got the grant that New York turned down. And then Rhonda Anderson was hired as our director for that project. And she's been here. We were talking, she's been here 14 years. That was 14 years ago she was hired. So she set up an office to work just on the environmental justice issue. Now, meanwhile, of course, we have the way that we're structured within the state of Michigan, we have a state chapter, which is based in Lansing. And then we have within maybe a half a dozen communities in the state, we have our local groups. And we have a local group in this area called the Southeast Michigan Group, which has four counties. And so we've been in existence for some time. Our organization in Southeast Michigan took a lot of leadership in air pollution that affected everybody. it was not just the black community, but everybody. And so our organization, when I began working in it, became a member of it in the late 80s, that was when the Detroit incinerator was under discussion. And then there was Sierra Club and Audubon and a lot of community organizations, especially in the Cass Corridor, had a lawsuit to try to keep that incinerator from being built. And the lawsuit was batted back and forth between the state and the federal courts for a number of years because nobody wanted to be
go up against
well, nobody, neither one of the state nor the feds wanted to dump it on somebody else, you know, very controversial issue. And it was intended as a regional incinerator. But of course, everybody wants their own thing, you know. So we had an incinerator in Madison Heights that served southeastern that's an area around southeastern Oakland County. Then we had a western Wayne County incinerator over Dearborn Heights and Inkster and Taylor in that area. We had one in the Grosse Pointes. And so everybody wanted their own incinerator, you know. So the Detroit incinerator was never a regional in terms of being funded and operated by a region. We have a regional authority, but the Highland Park was the only community that joined it, and they never really participated, especially the money. They never paid any money into it. But anyway, that was one of the areas where I became very heavily involved, and we're still at it, you know. And it's still a polluter that should be removed from the city. So we were in this on a legal basis. We lost the lawsuit, and part of the lawsuit was to have recycling as an option to incineration. And of course, they were not initially the pollution controls were very poor, very few pollution controls. And the state, within the course, it was 6 or 7 years before that case was heard in court. And it's the state regulators, the Department of Environmental Quality, as we call it now, they moved in during the course of that time before the suit went to trial. They moved in and required the city of Detroit to add additional pollution controls. They said they had erred on what should be required in terms of pollution controls. So this was during the Coleman Young administration. So it was sold to private business, and but the city kept all the liabilities. The city paid to, they got some cash to sell the incinerator, but they had to put on the pollution controls and that were required, and that took place over a period of several years. And then the cost of building and operating the incinerator and the pollution controls were all done through bond issues that the city had to pay out. So the city is still very much embedded in that incinerator, although it's been under private ownership since like 1990-91. An adjacent steam plant that Detroit Edison owned, which was later bought by a company called Detroit Thermal. They bought, it's a steam plant, basically a steam plant. It generates steam, and it doesn't generate electricity until the steam contract has been filled. So it was tied in with the steam plant, and the steam plant services the Midtown area, many of the institutions there. Wayne State pulled out of it in the early 2000s, somewhere. Wayne State pulled out of it and have their own generators, but Wayne State was a part of that. And many of the facilities in the Midtown area, the city buildings, all those are furnished steam from that from the Detroit Thermal, which bought the incinerator steam. And now the last time the incinerator was sold, the company that bought it bought both the incinerator and Detroit Thermal, so they own both of them. So this is a facility that the city will not pull away from.
Mm-hmm. They've curbed to certain regulations, though, correct? To help.
It's regulated by the state. Yes, yeah. There's the permit. Permits for operating the incinerator, mm-hmm. that meet the federal requirements. Okay. At the present time, there's a 5-year, they re-examine these permits in theory every 5 years, and you review them and so forth. And they are tested once a year by the state under that, that 5-year life of the permit. And throughout the whole history of the incinerator, the attitude of the state is that these are businesses and that they don't want to close them down. They want to keep them under control, you know. I mean, they want them to obey the rules, but they don't want to shut them down, okay? And because the incinerator is so large, it was designed as a regional facility. But they don't need it as a regional facility, but it was designed as such. And they have traditionally met the permit requirements. And initially, when the mercury was not regulated initially. The state, at some point along the way, began regulating mercury from these incinerators. But there was no federal rule on it. So you have a basic set of criteria that they have to meet, and they can allow them to release certain amounts of different toxins. And generally speaking, they have met their permit requirements. So we haven't been able to get much in the way of controls or backing away from that based on their permit, because they meet basically. And again, you know, the permit, the stack tests are scheduled in advance, you know, and they know when, you know, the time, they know when, what they're going to, you know, the choice of what they burn, you know.
Right, they can kind of alter or kind of.
Well, we
well, that's is, what the idea is anyway.
Yeah, so it's a situation where what we found in terms of the medical, where I worked a number of years on medical waste incinerators, mm-hmm. and with the National Healthcare Without Harm initiative to at the time, then the new regulations were being established for medical waste incinerators, which had been very poorly. Most of them were in hospitals, very poorly regulated. And we had a medical waste incinerator in the Henry Ford Hospital, and then we had a commercial medical waste incinerator in Hamtramck that was highly polluting. So the story there was that the hospitals themselves, they were more subject to pressure for for polluting than the cities, you know. And there was the National Healthcare Without Harm movement to get rid of the medical waste incinerators was very well organized and very well funded. It was a national program where they had, and we worked with the Ecology Center. We got involved in the Henry Ford incinerator because of our relationship with the Ecology Center in Ann Arbor. And
that's the Sierra Club and Ecology. That's
yeah, we okay. were part of the coalition. Mm-hmm. And I chaired that coalition, and we spent 3 years getting an agreement from the Henry Ford Hospital to close that incinerator and use an alternative method of treating medical waste. They burned everything, and not just the medical waste. And so that was the easiest incinerator project we had. You know?
Yeah.
But the Hamtramck was a commercial medical waste incinerator. And it was 12 or 14 years that the community and environmentalists fought that incinerator. The first solid waste incinerator was in Madison Heights for Southeast Oakland County. And that was a consortium of communities that burned their trash, and that was a solid waste incinerator. So anyway, to get back to medical waste incinerators, as a result of all this united campaign on this from the environmental groups and many others that were supporting us, all of the 159 medical waste incinerators that were operating in Michigan when these new rules were promulgated and we got into this, they were all closed. So that the Ecology Center worked very actively with the University of Michigan incinerators and medical incinerator in Ann Arbor. And there was one big commercial incinerator in the western part of the state that was closed after it was sold to, that was a long story, but anyway, one of our activists in the area from Hamtramck worked actively with one of those western state incinerators. And anyway, that campaign was, as I say, more successful than anything I've ever worked on. You know, and then there's still some incinerators, of course, left in Michigan, and no medical incinerators, but there's still, I think, there's one in Kent County and one in Genesee County, one in Detroit, and I don't think that's all the solid waste that are left in this state. The rest of them have been closed. So, but anyway, air pollution is an area where, in Southeast Michigan, we were involved in a lot of the leadership to fight these incinerators, and the result is in that people now are very well aware. They're very well aware of the asthma and the impact of these incinerators on their health. So that it's much more difficult to try to convince anybody that they're harmless, you know. And this has been one of the focuses of the environmental justice, you know, movement. We formed the Zero Waste Detroit Coalition at a time when we were approaching the end of the bond payments that the city had to make for the Detroit incinerator. And we had of course been in court with them. We lost our lawsuit in court. And we were still, you know, coming up in terms of budget hearings and all that, you know, to protest, you know, the amount of money still going into it and so forth. So, but when the city was approaching the end of the bond payments and the cashing out of it, you would say, Anthony Adams was the deputy mayor of Detroit at that time. It was in the Kilpatrick administration. And I went to him, and I attended the Greater Detroit Resource Recovery Authority, which was the name of the agency that was in charge of the incinerator. And I said, you know, he had initiated a study to what they would do when their bond payment was up. And I said, you know, we would like to work with you and have some input into this and see what we do in terms of trying to create a different situation, an alternative, you know, and not keep this thing. So we established, we started the Zero Waste Coalition as a way of getting more active involvement in trying to influence the city in terms of backing away from the incinerator and having curbside recycling and using the materials for economic development. And that's been our goal since we first started. And our focus in terms of when there are permit hearings, public hearings, you know, we furnish testimony on that. We testify. But in terms of long term, we're trying to educate the community and work with the community and with city officials to try to get people more involved with recycling and see that as the alternative you can get from recycling is far superior to, you know, to whatever you're going to get from burning the trash. Mm-hmm. And one of the regulatory issues that we haven't made any impact on is that in areas where you have these concentrations of industrial plants and sources of air pollution, it's a combined threat. And you have the combination of many sources. And the regulation should not be one by one with each plant, you know.
It should be across the board.
You should recognize the fact that it's a cumulative effect. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a killer. You know?
Right.
You know, and our position in terms of Sierra Club and Zero Waste has been that, you know, anything that you can reduce is good. But you still have the problem that you have a combined source that you're not solving the problem. You know, if you close one incinerator or get better pollution controls on one coal plant, you're not really solving the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, so you need a regulatory system that looks at the combination of the many sources of, and this is the area that the issue now that comes up over and over again with Detroit, because we do have these areas where you combine industrial pollution with mobile sources, highways, freeways, you have the mobile sources on those. And so you get these areas that get a tremendous amount of pollution from a number of different sources. And some of them aren't regulated, you know, anyway. So that's a constant struggle, and at this point in time, it seems to be getting worse. You know, not getting any, because of some of the recent proposals from EPA and in terms of the National Sierra Club policy. You know, the getting rid of the older coal plants that are heavily polluting and turning to renewable energy is our top priorities nationally, and we have a lot of activity in that area. So getting back to environmental justice, the organizations that have become involved with environmental justice issues create a much stronger voice within the grassroots level of on these issues. This has been in an area like Detroit, of course, this has been a very important development because we are a predominantly minority community.
Right.
And so an environmental, Eastern Michigan Environmental Council, for example, when I first started working in this issue, they did not have any grassroots activity at all. They worked with litigation and policy level, you know, with a group that was basically like Sierra Club. We're a white group that's middle class, and we're part of the problem, you know, in terms, unless you get involved, you know, and realize, you know, that we may be getting along okay or better if we're further out from these sources, if we're living, you know, out right. from direct what we think we're protected.
Right.
But
yeah, so. Like you said, it's getting bigger and spreading out, and you need to keep fighting.
Well, in a sense, it may not be getting bigger because, you know, we're losing our industrial base, you know.
That's true.
We lost it, I guess.
That's true, yes.
And unless you, we're certainly not adding more major industrial plants that are polluting, but the automobile
right.
and truck traffic is a major source. And this is, you know, and again, the last few years I've been a lot of heavily involved with the transit issue. Mm. And, you know, public transit is needed both for economic reasons, by people who ride it and don't have access to automobiles, but it's also needed in terms of getting, reducing pollution.
Yes, so I see downtown they're constructing on Woodward, the
M1 rail.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. Right now it just causes a lot of traffic back up, but I'm sure there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, the M1 rail is a small part of what needs to be done in terms of regional transit. You know, this is a drop in the bucket,
right.
You know, in terms of, and there were many years spent on hearings and projected plans and ways of funding rail on the whole Woodward corridor that, you know, didn't go forward, and then this M1 rail is a piece of that that is basically a circulatory system in the, you know, the central business district, and it's not. It's a small part of the kind of transit that we need. We need a good regional system where people can get to work. The balance in terms of employment and transit, 70% of the employed people in the city of Detroit come to Detroit from the suburbs. 70% of the Detroiters who are employed work in the suburbs.
Hmm, I did not know that.
Okay. So, well, they may be 71, 72, you know, but this mm-hmm. is basically 70%. So you have an influx of working people coming into Detroit to work, and you have the majority of Detroiters who are working going to the suburbs for jobs. And majority of people in Detroit are heavily dependent on transit, and we have a long way to go with public transit because you have to have money to run a transit
right.
system. And,
this Metro Detroit was kind of built against that, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Because of the
exactly.
automakers.
Yeah, yeah, the car culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have to
reverse
we
that.
We have to get people away from the car culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as I say, the transit has economic advantages whether you drive a car or not, but the basic thing is that the cars are not the best form of transit in terms of the environment, you know, or the buses, or the trucks, you know. And we need more use of rail and water and water transit and more public transit where you can reduce the amount of emissions by going in a bus as opposed to everybody driving their own car.
Yeah, the definite car culture in this area is
oh yes,
big.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Are there other issues besides the air pollution that are important in today's like environmental justice movement?
Well, certainly the in terms of the whole. How should I say this? The basic economic structure here is, you know, has been relied on manufacturing, and to the extent that Michigan and Detroit are trying to maintain a manufacturing and a presence in the future. You know, using renewables for generating plants and you know, and generating electricity. You know, our electricity needs are of vital importance. And to the extent that people can participate in this kind of a society, you know, unless we have better education and we have young people that are prepared for competing in this kind of climate, you know, with so that, you know, the kind of economy that we're getting into is really vital, because people have to survive, you know, have to work, and they have to have, there has to be some place that they can fit into an economy and be self-sustaining as a family and as individuals. And the direction we're going in now, the environmental justice community is involved in the pollution controls and involved in beginning to get involved in climate change issue, you know, of using more renewables and using more energy efficiency and so forth. That would ward off, to the extent that we can, ward off the climate change that's taking place. But the other part of that is people have to have an economic stake in whatever's going on. And that's the issue that where we don't seem to, this is not the issue that the environmental justice movement is involved in to any extent, I don't think. The environmental justice movement is given a very strong voice, and they, in terms of agreements like the Marathon Oil, you know, where these companies get into these agreements where they're going to train people and employ them, and then they don't, you know, these kind of economic benefits agreements. The environmental justice community is supporting those. They're up for, you know, there's a lot of discussion about that now in Detroit. And there's a place for this, you know, that more participation the better.
Right. How would people, especially the youth, if they want to get involved, how could they do that right now?
Well, I'm not sure. One of the issues now, you know, I worked 20 years with the city in terms of the federal job training money, and the issues that we always had before us with job training was that the public schools and it was such that and when we tested out our clients, you know, a lot of them read at the sixth grade level and did math at the fourth or fifth grade level. They weren't really prepared to enter into any kind of occupational training that would be a good source of income in the future, because they didn't have the background to, a lot of them didn't have the background to participate, you know. So educational system is extremely important. And, you know, this gets back to, you know, in terms of politics, you know, you have to be involved in electing people that are going to make good decisions. Mm-hmm. And
seems like a full circle.
This is you know, one of the issues right now before us, especially in the Detroit area, is, you know, you've got to find some way to get the schools providing young people with a solid education that then can lead them to something in an occupational future, you know. And this has been a problem for some time. I mean, the auto plants, you know, they began automating, you know, I guess back in the 60s, you know. certainly by the time I was working in this field in the 70s. And so to the extent that you automate the plants, you eliminate the jobs that don't require technical skills, computer skills, and it's what we call the skills twist. You know, they used to have two-thirds of the plants that would involve people that were unskilled, basically, and maybe a third of skills. So it's flipped over now, so that two-thirds of the people employed in these plants and manufacturing companies will be skilled, and a third will be maybe a third unskilled, you know. So the whole future, you know, of all this global competition, you know, where industry's moving to countries where they can pay low wages and make more money off of paying low wages and all that, it seems to be going forward.
Seems like a constant struggle and fight to get.
So we, you know, in terms of what the one of the reasons that I like Sierra Club is that we are active politically. We are a 504 company. You know, I mean, it's a company organization where we can work politically. But you've got to get people in public office that have some understanding of what's needed, and then are willing to work for on those things and do things that, you know, to regulate industry and to shape opportunities for people through providing them with better education and better, more opportunities to learn how to perform what's needed to keep the economy going and keep themselves going. At this point, I don't think the environmental justice groups are targeting themselves in those areas necessarily. There is a lot of concern in Detroit, as you know, for improving the school system. There's no question about that. But the way that it's been done so far through these financial managers and, you know, it's people are hoping for the best.
Right.
A lot of this, we certainly haven't solved these problems. And I don't even know if we really attacked. It's very discouraging to see that that the school system, until you have a good school system in Detroit, you're not going to have what you need in terms of people having a chance. That the people dependent on the public school system have a chance to get the kind of backgrounds that they need in order to survive, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask you, is there anything else you'd like to talk about? Because I know we covered a lot of different things, but was there anything important that you'd like to discuss besides what we've discussed?
Well, I think that I would like to see, I guess, more effort on the part of our environmental groups and our environmental justice groups to work more closely together. I say we have an environmental justice program in Detroit, which I'm very happy to have that here. But in terms of the way that things happen, you know, I think we would benefit from a broader coalition of organizations that are working together on closer together on some of these issues, and not what we've tried to do in the Zero Waste Group. Is that we've tried to get a variety of different kinds of organizations involved. And I don't know if you've looked at our list of, member groups.
Why it's called a coalition.
Yeah, we have 22 organizations. And we've tried very hard to get a broad representation, which includes not only the environmental groups, but the and community groups and different kinds of community groups that cover a spectrum of the more broader spectrum of the population than just the environmental groups mm-hmm. as such.
Because they are connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that needs to be done, you know, on a much larger basis in terms of all these environmental justice issues. I think we need to, and if you don't get involved in the political aspects of it, you know, the political structure and the structure of the government is something that you have to take into account in terms of getting some of these things accomplished. Because, you know, one of the, within the city of Detroit, for example, you know, our municipal ordinance, which of course has been put on hold, you know, for a couple of years now. But the mayor has 98-99% of the power, you know, and he runs the city. And the city council has always been open to the community to come and make their complaints and talk about all their problems. And they, you know, it's a full-time job, you know, full-time activity. But the council really has no power except reviewing the budget and interacting with the mayor over the budget, you know. So we need a different form of government in this city of Detroit at this point in time, you know, to have a full-time council that is at its best points interested in the population and all their problems, and yet they have no power. And the mayors have had all the power and then taken more, you know. And to get some kind of government structure that will give people, and to have people voting for people that will give them kind of representation that's going to really solve these problems. That's a tremendous need. We've been the financial manager's been making all the decisions for a couple of years, you know, and I think he's going to be with us much longer, but even though the state is now, you know, taking over to replace him, you know, monitoring the city, but you've got to get people to understand, in some way, people have to understand that they have to participate and they have to educate themselves and they have to vote. You know, and vote for people that really have something to offer, as opposed to, you know, just familiar names and this type of thing. Yeah. So I think the working together in terms of the political agenda is something that's an area where we certainly need to do much more than we're doing now. To say Sierra Club endorses candidates, and we meet with candidates, we lobby. And a lot of the nonprofits, they're not allowed to endorse candidates and be as active as we are. They certainly are also interested in lobbying on these issues, on the environmental issues. But I think we need to expand that greatly. Because I don't see that we're making that much progress in terms of what we're doing with change within the city. There's a tremendous number of people now that are involved in meetings and groups that are working on different aspects of recovery in Detroit. Mm-hmm. But how it's all going to work out, you know, is yet to be determined. And until you have some kind of governmental structure where you have more accountability and you have more focus on what people really need, you know, the environmental aspect of it is just one aspect of it.
Right. Well, I know you're not going to give up, and I know that. There are a lot of people that share the same views and mm-hmm. want to fight for mm-hmm. all those issues. So, mm-hmm. thank you very much for your time.
Mm-hmm.
And appreciate it very much.
Well, I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.